Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Living in the pause. Tom sent something that I found interesting earlier this week, and if you'll permit me, daily decisions. We have countless decisions to make every day, but they are not decisions about things over which we have no control. They are decisions about how we choose to see the people, places, and things we do not control, and about how we respond. The first choice we have about responding is whether or not to respond at all. And to kind of like bring in something Alan had talked about before we started recording, we're all like political junkies in my family. And I am dividing my time these days between my parents' place and my girlfriend's place in different corners of LA. And anyway, like my dad, I could just hear him grumbling in the other room just because he's just streaming cable news, and he's got Daily Kos on his laptop, and he's got different things, and just so mad about whatever Trump's doing this day or that day.
Well, listen, right now, this shit show, that it's unbelievable how people have really fallen into a trance with this guy.
When I'm really like emotionally sober, I'm in touch with my prime directive, which is love my dad, support my dad. I don't need to really interject my opinion about much. I just need to be there and support him. And also to, if I can, to help him, redirect him, because he's getting cancer treatment now, redirect him towards a place that's going to be a little healthier and a little more stable for him to get well.
You know, you talk about watching cable news and just grumbling all the time. I'm not going to run that energy through my body every single day. I'm going to pay attention to what's going on, and I'm going to do the things I can. Exactly what I just wrote about in that thing. I'm going to work. I'm going to make decisions about things I can. And I actually have something to say about. I need to sit here and focus on talking to my friends here and doing this podcast.
I don't always succeed, which I'm sure will come as a huge shock to you guys.
It is.
You believe it, Tommy? He doesn't always succeed. And my God, we failed him. Let's just talk about the difference between a reaction and a response. Because you were, I think, it's such a good job at laying out what a response looks like. Is that, you know, in a response, you know, you get into that gap between the stimulus and your reaction. And in that gap, you identify all the possible choices that you can make in terms of what, how to respond to the situation. And as you're saying, Tom, out of all of those possibilities, whatever they are, and look, you know, we throw our weight on one of those choices versus another. We come up with what is my best response given the situation I'm facing right now, right? And hopefully one of the things that guides your best response is to somehow think, is this going to enhance the encounter I'm having, or is it going to subtract from it, right? And hopefully we make decisions that are going to give something to us and not take away. So that's a response. It's thoughtful. It's integrating all the information about what's going on, how we're feeling, what, who's involved. I mean, all of that comes into play and gets, you know, synthesized and integrated into the best possible response. Now, a reaction is, in contrast, a reaction is based on anxiety. And anxiety is perceiving, is that we perceive some kind of real or imagined threat in the situation. And as soon as I get threatened, now I want to move into that protective mode. And so my reaction is mostly going to try to take care of myself without an awareness of all of the other variables. And invariably, that reaction is going to, you know, not be in my best interest.
Far more often than real threat is an imaginary threat. I've made up a story, you know, like I have a friend of mine used to call it the director of fiction in her head, you know, and would always make up stories. And it's like she said, there were never any good stories. It was always what was horrible going to happen next. But the idea is, even just to give yourself that challenge, maybe. I mean, I'm not one for giving assignments in therapy, for instance, but all of a sudden I'm just thinking in terms of, wow, if I may give myself this assignment. If, you know, whenever I'm feeling that anxiety, just to ask myself, what is the story? What is the imaginary threat? And if we can start to learn how that director of fiction works, you know, so that, because I always tell people, you know, and I was listening to some Ron Doss this morning coming into to work, and you know, and it makes me feel good about our work, my work, when I read back over that stuff, or I listen to people like that and realize they came up with the same stuff we're coming up with. You know, it's like, and the main thing is you can't get rid of anything. You're not going to get rid of whatever crazy you got. You're not going to get rid of your addiction. We're not going to get rid of our OCD. We're not, you know, we're going to change our relationship with it. That's why I punctuated that little piece I wrote with, the first choice I have is whether or not to respond. I am such a knee-jerk reactor. I'm learning. I'm better at it, but I'm not by nature thoughtful. I'm going to ping-pong it back and forth and get it there. So the idea of any of this stuff that can slow me down and ask, okay, what's real about this? What's not real about it? If I want to respond this way, is it going to do it, me or anybody else? Is there a benefit? And very often there's not, other than just kind of entertaining myself.
Well, right. A consequence of not taking the pause is that you haven't decided what you want to do, or what your priorities are, or
yourself that space for thoughtfulness.
Right, and what you were saying about real and imagined threats ties right into the choice to respond or not respond at all. It's just it's parsing emotional sobriety, right? It's looking through everything through a framework of the problem is not the problem; it's the way that we react to it.
I'll speak for myself that this is an issue for me. Is if I'm in a conversation or if I'm in an exchange somewhere, if I don't think it through, I will act as if I need whatever I'm going to say. I need to do it now. I don't. You know, my wife is a wonderful role model for this. She processes stuff. She takes it in. She will listen, and she'll talk about it later. She'll say, you know, I've been thinking about what we were talking about earlier. I have to really think about that because I do not do that naturally, and it can be really helpful.
You know, in Al-Anon, they have a saying: use the following criteria if you're going to say something. Do I need to say it? Does it need to be said now?
Oh, I've heard that before. I've never thought, but you're right. Dee Dee lives by that.
She lives in the pause. And look, I think healthy people, it's a sign of mental health to be able to manage our, you know, reactions so that they become responses.
If I could circle back to identifying real and imagined threats. So there have been a lot of plane crashes lately in the news, and some of this I have a hunch is correlates to defunding of, you know, the FAA, or a certain kind of like stripping of the certain functions of government. There may be some regulatory absence that's causing some of these crashes, and I've got to fly 6 times this year at least. Maybe more than that. The emotionally sober way to process that would be, well, are you on a plane now? You know, like there's kind of a gradient to how much I need to be, how in touch I need to be with that particular, with something that's not happening right now. You know,
statistically, it's way safer to fly than to drive around. It's like there's no doubt about that.
You see, watch out, Patrick, because it's not a fact that those were caused by defunding. Or not. There was a mechanical failure on the one jet that has nothing to do with defunding. And then the other one, that was more of a problem with air traffic control and army traffic control, and not getting coordinated. And that's not a defunding thing. So don't assign it to that. This would be an MSNBC fact check. That's not what caused those two things. So we got to be careful, because see, when we assign it to stuff like that, then we create a fantasy that becomes catastrophic.
And we stop being curious, and we need to stay curious.
Gotta stay curious, man, because as soon as I start to imagine things rather than stay grounded in the reality of things, I'm typically gonna run into trouble.
Yeah, no kid.
Not 100% of the time, but what did you call it? The director of fiction?
The director of fiction,
I mean, it's author of fiction. It's exactly what we do, is we create these stories. And you know what Rollo May said, who's a was a brilliant psychologist, he said the threat is always a threat to our existence. That's what the experience of anxiety. If you're imagining, let's say your girlfriend's cheating on you, then if she cheats on me, I'm a nothing. You see what I mean? It relates to our existence. It always, so the plane crash, it's obvious how it relates to our existence. You're no longer here. But you see, he was really right about that. You know where he discovered it? When he had tuberculosis and he was in a hospital with all these other patients, and he was seeing that the fear that every one of them had was that they'd be nothing.
Oh,
They
that's
just,
cool. Yeah.
yeah. And so it was a brilliant insight that he brought into psychology, because there's a lot of other ideas about what causes anxiety, psychoanalytic ideas, you know, stuff from behaviorism and stuff like that. But I think for us, understanding that it's somehow a perceived threat to us.
Yeah.
Now, that's different than fear. A fear is if I got a gun pointed at you and I said, I'm going to blow your brains out, you better be afraid. You don't need to imagine what's going to happen. It's happening. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a gun pointed to my head right now.
Right. Well, one of the things I'm thinking about is that you're helping me validate the points I make in embracing fear, which is I use the technique I call, and it's not, it's just my version of it. It's just cognitive therapy. It's like I call it going down the ladder. It's like, and it's what I like fear under the fear under the fear. Okay, well, I'm afraid I'm going to be late for work. Okay, well, if you're going to be late for work, what's going to happen? I'm going to be in trouble with the boss. Okay, if you're in trouble with the boss, well, I'm going to lose my job. Okay, if you're going to lose your job, what happens? Well, my wife is going to leave me. It's like, I mean, you go just a few rungs down the ladder, and it is existential. It's like I'm going to fucking die, and it's like and that's really where I mean I've always think it's I love pointing out to people it never takes more than three or four steps down that ladder to get to something that's huge, and it may be something as little as like with my example just then is I'm going to be late.
You know what's a sign of progress is when I imagine my own death now. Part of the fear is tied to the knowledge that there's something I'm doing that will be interrupted, that
Yes.
there's ambitions I have, or
Oh
there's,
man, I've said that. I've
yeah.
said that for years. That I always want my fear of death to be the fear of interruption. Don't bother me now. I'm busy. Rather than all this other stuff I've had in the past. It's like, yeah.
It
That's
didn't used
and
to
then
be like
it just
that.
means you're gonna stay busy until you drop off the planet. Yeah.
Try to anyway.
A friend of mine's wife. I just went to the funeral not long ago, and they're 80, I guess, but both in good health, and it's like, and I mean this is literally true. His wife just dropped dead. No, she hadn't been ill, anything that we knew about. And when I talked to him, he said, no, we were actually standing in our living room. And she dropped over, and then she was dead. And the paramedics came. He said it was here one day. It's like, and so one of the things many we got into the conversation was the idea that, well, yeah, there's a lot of what else would she have done if she wanted to get ready for that? But what he said too is like no prolonged illness, no being handicapped. I mean, it's like she was basically good and healthy until the moment she wasn't. It's like, it's and that's she would, I mean, I said that she was just interrupted.
I was just reading with a sponsee about step 10 yesterday. This is the kind of thing where if we're keeping inventory and kind of managing our lives in the short term or day to day, that we have a good chance of kind of settling business with our loved ones as it arises. Maybe there wouldn't be as much unsaid when something crazy like that happens. That's just what I think of.
Yeah, I call it living by the regret reduction program. You live each day as if as if one day you're going to get a chance to review it, and you would just say to this day, nah, let it ride. That's good. And most of those days are not going to be spectacular days. They're just going to be good days in which we live according to our value system.
Alan, I wanted to circle back. And so we were talking about living in the pause, and you were talking about some existential fears that you were having. Now, I imagine that one way of dealing with your own fears is you just, and you doing what you do, you just reach out to other people and you try to help them in the way that you don't maybe know how to help yourself yet.
You know, first of all, like if we go down the ladder that Tom's talking about is, you know, one of the things I say is take it to imagine the worst and can you deal with it? That's another way that I've approached the thing that Tom does with the ladder is,
yeah,
let's follow that. Yeah. So if that happens, then what happens next? Then what's next? And what's next? And we just walk down the ladder, as Tom says, or go
That's
up
right.
The ladder, whatever way you want to think about it. And if the last thing is that, God, I won't exist anymore, mm-hmm. you know, that's a reality. I mean, the one thing none of us escape is death. That's coming. Mm-hmm. The issue becomes is how we live until we die. And really mm-hmm. is the big thing. And do I want fear to control my life? Typically, I don't give fear that kind of authority in my life. You know, and I think it's a result of, you know, who I am, being in the Marine Corps. We were trained to not let fear make our decisions. It was the objective that we were focused on. Not that you may get shot, you may not. But the issue is taking that hill or that bunker or whatever it was. I think that helped a lot. And they put you in situations that were really dangerous. I mean, we would climb under, you know, 30 caliber machine gun shooting over our heads. And if you stand up, you're dead. I mean, and we would practice that stuff where you're in a situation there is a real threat to your existence. I mean, bullets are real and they're going to cut you up, man, if you stand up. So, you know, I think that that helped, but I think it's also a thing of, in terms of, I think Tom is saying this too, like when he was talking about, I'm too old for that, is where do I want to invest my energy in my, you know, do I want to invest it in a bad investment, which is what is this fear going to yield me? Not much. It's going to reduce my life. It's going to shrink my life. It's going to fill me with dread. I'm going to be cautious and suspicious and hypervigilant. Is that how I want to live my life? Or do I want to live my life kind of embracing them each moment and being aware, if I become fearful, how to deal with it?
We inadvertently, in this whole long conversation we call a podcast, we hit definition upon definition of emotional sobriety, and you just gave one of them. It's understanding. And it goes back to what Patrick read that I wrote the other day. It's understanding that, first of all, just logically, I only have power over myself. That's it. So all the what you're talking about is all the fretting and worrying, all that other stuff, everything that's about other people, places, and things is by definition wasted. It's like, you know, it's like I'm punching holes in my gas tank and then wondering why I'm getting bad gas mileage. It's like because that's what you're talking about is making an adjustment to our value system that basically just is a correction that we need from our training in life, which is, you know, we can influence other things in our life and we do that, but it's like, that's not, you've got to come from where you got to come from your power, and that's within yourself, and that's it. You know, how you respond to this is all you can decide at any given time.
Yeah. David Snart says the most important time to keep your mouth shut is when you know you're right. And I think that if you don't take anything from this podcast, but that'll save you a lot of trouble and a lot of regrets, I mean, in your life. You know, I like what you said, Tom. Can we at least shoot for a regret-free life where I end each day? And this is what I think Bill's intention was when he said, you know, take a daily inventory, you know, in addition to the spot check inventory, and ask yourself, hey, is there anything that I need to clean up from today? You know, did I honor myself? Did I honor other people? Did I, You know, did I act with integrity? Do I have amends to make to someone? How can I aim for the best possible attitude? See, all of that. And that's another definition of emotional sobriety. We're aiming to have the best possible attitude towards our life and towards our relationships and towards our relationship with ourselves.
And we can't change the past. We all know that, but we fret about it and we still have our regrets. But it just occurred to me just this moment that basically when we do what you are describing, then what we do is we can heal our regrets of the past. Because if I'm doing what I need to do in my recovery, which I've been doing and doing, you know, hopefully improving all the time over the last 39 years, is like if you ask me if I regret, you know, my drinking years, all this other stuff, I'm going, well, you know, yeah, if you took each little piece and say, would you regret this? If this happened today, would you? But it's like in the bigger picture, no, I don't regret any of that because that's how I got here. You know, if that hadn't been my history, if I hadn't been that fucked up, I would not be sitting here talking to you guys.
Took me a while to get there. I mean, I'm a little behind you, but I never imagined that the way that I came to my current life, you know, that I would be grateful for it because it's been such a tumultuous journey.
But we can be grateful for all of it.
And Alan, I see you. Trump is very scary. I do not like him. And it really bothers me.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.